Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, recording at our Hideaway studio in East County. Today, we're going to be talking about Donald Trump's economic plan. We'll tell you about a new law in California to provide court rights for immigrants. We'll be discussing a lethal use of force by deputies in a Santee SWAT team standoff with a suspect who fired a crossbow at deputies. Learn about a recycling center fire in Spring Valley. And on Green Scene, we'll tell you about some upcoming meetings this week that La Mesa is inviting residents to on climate change. From Public News Service, we'll tell you about a California plan to bring voting centers to communities statewide. We'll have news about an Orchid Award nomination for the New County Library in Alpine. And then our newsmaker interview today will be with Mark Jorgensen. He's an expert on bighorn sheep, the former superintendent of the Anza Borrego Desert State Park, and the author of a new book called Bighorn Sheep, Wilderness Icons. Now, if you're a parent, we'll tell you what you need to know about a new law impacting vaccines before you send your kids back to school. And finally, we'll be re-airing our interview with Don Axe, an expert on urban farming. So stay tuned for all of these stories and more on today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show, where East County matters. Donald Trump laid out his economic agenda, promising to jumpstart the American economy in a speech in Detroit Monday. The plan calls for tax cuts, dismantling trade pacts, slashing regulations on businesses, eliminating Obamacare, and boosting production and burning of coal, which produces greenhouse gas emissions blamed by scientists for climate change. His rival, Democratic presidential nominee Hillary Clinton, slammed Trump's plan in a tweet stating, "Donald Trump's economic plan, lower wages, fewer jobs, more debt, tax breaks for the 0.1%. While that's oversimplistic, since Trump's plan does include eliminating income taxes for those earning under $25,000 and proposes a child care tax credit, many of his proposals do favor the rich and large corporations. The wealthy real estate magnate pledged to eliminate estate taxes, lower the business tax rate to 15%, let businesses take deductions immediately instead of waiting till year's end, and cut income tax brackets down to just 3, with the wealthiest Americans paying no more than 33%. Faulting Democratic policies for trade pacts that have shipped jobs overseas, such as auto worker jobs in Detroit, Trump reiterated his opposition to the Trans-Pacific Trade Partnership, which Clinton now says she opposes, but which has been supported by President Obama. Trump slammed his opponent, Clinton, for her past support of free trade deals, stating, "I expect Detroit will get that apology right around the same time Hillary Clinton turns over those 33,000 emails she deleted." Trump also said he would eliminate the Affordable Health Care Act, or Obamacare, but he has laid out no plans to make health care affordable or accessible, nor to prevent going back to the pre-Obamacare problems, such as insurance companies being able to deny coverage for people with pre-existing conditions. He repeatedly touted his plan as what's needed to make America great again. He added that he wants to build the next generation of roads, bridges, and other infrastructure, and send new skyscrapers soaring. "It will be American workers who are hired to do the job. Americanism, not globalism, will be our new credo," said Trump, who ironically has relied largely on foreign workers and products made overseas for his own business empire. Previously, some economists have said that Trump's emphasis on more tax cuts would add to the deficit. He has also not spelled out how he would fund those critical needs, such as the infrastructure funding he calls for, Social Security or emergency health funding for the Zika virus, while drastically slashing the nation's revenues. Trump also called for creating more jobs for coal workers by boosting production of coal and cutting restrictions on pollution from coal-fired plants. That prompted the Daily Edge to tweet this critical barb: "Trump will end the clean energy boom and take away your health care, replacing it with a $7-an-hour job in a coal mine with no safety equipment." Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice, this is Miriam Raftery.
A bill by Assemblywoman Lorena Gonzalez, a San Diego Democrat, aims to assure that an injured person in California receives fair compensation for future income loss and future medical costs, regardless of their immigration status. The measure has been approved by the state Senate on a bipartisan 28-11 vote and next goes to the governor for signature. The California legislature has, over the years, passed laws protecting the rights of undocumented people in employment and other areas. However, these protections do not currently extend to individuals seeking recovery of fair compensation for their injuries through our civil justice system. Assembly Bill 2159 would override a 1968 court case that allowed civil damages to be limited to what immigrants might have earned in their home countries, even though they are living in California and rely on income from the jobs they perform here. Gonzalez says, California has spent decades working to ensure people are not additionally penalized for their immigration status, and AB 2159 would close an accidental loophole benefiting those who seek to exploit immigrants. Supporters of the measure include the ACLU of California, labor and immigrant rights organizations. No letters of opposition were received according to the Legislative Council's bill analysis. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice, this is Jonathan Getz.
This is East County Magazine's Crime Beat. On the streets, reporting on crimes impacting communities across our region, helping to keep you safe and informed.
This is Miriam Raftery with a Crime Beat report. A man who reportedly threatened to kill his mother prompted a SWAT team intervention Friday afternoon at a home on Woodland Vista Drive in Santee that ended with the suspect dead. According to Lieutenant Greg Reilersdam with the Sheriff's Homicide Detail, deputies responded to a call from the suspect's mother, who said her adult son had threatened to kill her and may have an undiagnosed mental condition. She also said he may have weapons, including an axe and a knife. Deputies met the mother outside and got keys to the home, then through an open front door called for the man to come outside. But instead, Lieutenant Reilersdam says, the man peeked around a corner and fired an arrow from a crossbow at the deputies, striking the doorway near where they stood. Deputies retreated and called for help, also trying to call the man by phone and a PA announcement. More officers arrived and prepared to take the man into custody if he came out. But then he appeared at an upstairs window and fired more arrows from the crossbow at deputies in front of the home. In response, deputies returned fire, possibly striking the man who stopped firing from the window, said Lieutenant Reilersdam. Deputies from the sheriff's special enforcement detail used sound and light devices as well as electronic surveillance cameras and determined that the man was lying on the floor in an upstairs bedroom. Deputies later entered the home and medics pronounced the man deceased. Some have questioned whether non-lethal means, such as tear gas, might have been deployed to save the man's life. In response, Sheriff's spokesperson Jan Caldwell says, lethal force had to be employed as an arrow can travel long distances, and we were concerned for the safety of the community. This was a two-story residence, and he had the advantage of elevation and position with a deadly weapon. Caldwell adds that use of tear gas may have only further angered him and sent him from the structure into the neighborhood with a bow and arrow, perhaps an axe or knives, and or guns. Another news outlet has reported that the suspect had posted kill police messages on his social media earlier in the day, the very same day that a murdered San Diego police officer was being laid to rest. The medical examiner's office will be conducting an autopsy to determine the cause and manner of the man's death. His identity is being withheld pending his identification and family notification. In accordance with sheriff's procedure and practices, the names of the officers involved in the shooting will be released 3 days after the incident.
A firefighter was injured by a falling stack of cardboard while battling a blaze at a recycling center Tuesday morning on Bancroft Drive in Spring Valley. The fire damaged residents at a duplex next door and resulted in evacuation of several other houses, sent up plumes of smoke seen across the area. Cal Fire and Heartland Fire crews responded to the blaze, which forced closure of Bancroft Drive until the fire was contained 2 hours later. Firefighters remained on scene until nighttime to douse hot spots. The injured firefighter was treated at Sharp Memorial Hospital. Sheriff's officials are investigating the cause of the fire. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Chisato Everson.
Now it's time for the Green Scene Report, highlighting energy, environmental, and sustainability issues in our community.
This is Jonathan Getz with the Green Scene Report. The City of La Mesa is seeking public input on its draft climate action plan. A climate action plan spells out how a jurisdiction, its residents, and businesses achieve specific reductions in greenhouse gas emissions. Two public meetings are planned with the City's Environmental Sustainability Commission on August 16th and September 19th. Both meetings will be held at 7 p.m. in council chambers at City Hall. Angela Deegan with SanDiego350.org, a nonprofit group dedicated to stopping climate change, states, "These are great opportunities for you and your neighbors to help shape the plan that will guide the City of La Mesa to a clean energy future over the next 20 years. The environmental group says La Mesa residents are needed to provide input and assure that La Mesa adopts a strong, enforceable climate action plan, which includes a goal of 100% clean energy and incentivizes renewable energy and local green jobs."
The state of California is considering scrapping the neighborhood polling place by 2018 in favor of more vote-by-mail balloting accompanied by new vote centers. Experts testified at two informational hearings at the state assembly on Tuesday to explain the concept, modeled after a system used in Colorado where voter participation went up by 3 percentage points after taking effect statewide 2 years ago. Mindy Romero with the California Civic Engagement Project at UC Davis explains all registered voters would automatically receive a mail-in ballot.
The goal is to make voting easier for people, hoping that turnout will increase and participation will increase in California. That's a question mark, but that is the hope.
A majority of California voters already vote by mail. For people who still want to cast a ballot in person, the vote centers would be open for several weeks ahead of the election, with longer hours and on weekends. Compared to today's polling places, there would be fewer vote centers, but voters could go to any center in the county, not just the one in their district. Romero authored a study on voting centers released last week that found that young people and Latinos tend to favor voting in person. So, she says, extensive targeted outreach would be necessary.
For Latinos in particular, there are so many aspects of the polling place experience that they prefer. The social aspect, being able to know that their vote is counted, more hesitancy of sending their ballot through the mail and trusting the post office.
Senate Bill 450 to establish vote centers has already passed the State Senate and the Assembly Elections Committee. It's now in the Assembly Appropriations Committee. The vote center program would be voluntary for counties. So far, 14 counties have shown an interest in the idea. For Public News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
The new county library at Alpine has been nominated for an Orchid Award in the San Diego Architectural Foundation's annual Orchids and Onions Awards. The project was created through the design-build team of C.W. Driver, Ferguson Pape Baldwin Architects, and architect Manuel Oncina, selected in a competitive design process. From indoor trees for kids to cozy up and read under, to an outdoor patio with a park view, plus many specialized spaces and plenty of high-tech amenities, the spacious new library is both beautiful and innovative in its design, using natural elements and Native American features. It's also energy efficient as the county's first zero-net energy building, and next up, the county is seeking LEED Gold certification. 4 times larger than the old library, the new facility on Alpine Boulevard can hold over 42 million books. In addition, the new Alpine Library will double as a safety zone for rural residents during fires and other emergencies. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
You're listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, the network for social justice.
Now, straight from the headlines, bringing you our latest top newsmakers. This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, people-powered radio, recording at our Hideaway studio in East County. Today, my very special guest is Mark Jorgensen. Mark was the longtime supervisor of the Anzabrego Desert State Park. He is a biologist, and he is now the author of a book on bighorn sheep called Desert Bighorn, Wilderness Icons. Mark, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me today.
So tell us a little bit about your background studying bighorn sheep through the years and how you got interested in this particular topic.
I started actually in my teens and visited Anza Borrego very often. I grew up in above El Cajon in Fletcher Hills. Took every opportunity I could to get out to the desert where I found a lot of freedom. Mm-hmm. And bighorn sheep just really grabbed my mind, and I was totally intrigued by an animal that could survive in such a harsh landscape.
Yeah, they are amazing, the way they can just scramble up a steep, rocky face and survive on so very little water in such a forbidding environment out there. And they're beautiful, beautiful creatures. So how many of these desert bighorn sheep do we have left today, and are they endangered?
In San Diego County now, we're at a very high level, probably higher than we've had in 40 or 50 years, we think.
Really?
Probably over 600 in mm-hmm. San Diego County. And the population that we study is called a peninsular bighorn in the peninsular mountains from Palm Springs to the Mexican border. Yeah. And we feel there are probably about 1,000 bighorn in that group now.
Okay. And does that include, there are also some of these in northern Mexico, correct?
Correct. Baja California has quite a few distinct populations. One population now that we think is derived from a core population in Carrizo Gorge has now repopulated the area around Interstate 8 and Mountain Springs Grade, and we've documented through radio telemetry those animals crossing the border into northern Baja.
Very good news. So in the entire world, which basically the southwestern areas here and northern Mexico, how many peninsular bighorn are there on the planet?
Well, desert bighorn, which peninsular are a subspecies of, we estimate now there are about 31,000.
Mm-hmm.
And we feel that's probably the highest population we've had throughout the Southwest and northern Mexico in probably 75 or 80 years.
That's very good news. Now, how many of those are the peninsular subspecies that we have here in San Diego's East County, out in Borrego and so forth?
About 1,000 within the United States, and then probably another 1,000 of that group in Mexico.
Yeah, so there's only 2,000 of them. So even though the population has increased, would you say this is still something that we should be very concerned about, making sure we don't take missteps that could imperil these animals?
Exactly. We have an increasing population in 7 U.S. states and 6 states within Mexico. These animals, desert bighorn, were extinct in the state of Texas. They were extinct in 3 states in northern Mexico. Now, through a lot of very diligent efforts, they've been brought back.
Nice.
They've been transplanted. But we can never be really too cautious. We have to understand what caused them to go extinct in some of those areas in the first place and make sure those things don't happen again.
Right. So what are the biggest threats to the bighorn sheep locally here in San Diego and Imperial counties, as well as northern Mexico?
The biggest threat we have overall in the Southwest has been diseases derived from domestic livestock.
Ah.
We don't have a lot of that in our local desert areas,
mm-hmm.
although we do still have signs that we have some pneumonia problems that take out young animals especially. And we're seeing certain canyon areas, certain subpopulations that are really having trouble rearing their young through that first summer.
Is there anything that can be done to protect them from that?
We have been trying to work with interagency groups and with ranchers, livestock operators, to make sure that we have no domestic sheep and no domestic goats anywhere within bighorn sheep habitat.
Yeah.
Now, one issue about our animals crossing the border now into northern Baja is the lack of controls in Baja with livestock operators. So these animals that spend much of their time in California could cross the border,
mm-hmm.
make contact with domestic sheep or goats, and turn around and bring those disease agents back to their herd mates back in California. And really, those things can spread very rapidly.
Right. Now, the border issue is kind of a double-edged sword, though, isn't it? Because on the one hand, they can get exposed to diseases down there. But on the other hand, they have historically crossed the border back and forth seasonally for water sources, maybe food sources. And how is the border wall? We hear a lot of talk these days, Donald Trump and others, about let's just wall off the entire border. A good portion of it already is here in San Diego County. How is that impacting the bighorn sheep here?
So far, we have held off the triple fence and the high walls within bighorn habitat in San Diego and Imperial County. We need to really monitor that situation. When you look at the entire border, Arizona, New Mexico, California, you have to be concerned about many large mammals that have been crossing that border for hundreds of thousands of years. Jaguar, pronghorn, and bighorn.
And can they get through or over the wall that we have out there in East County? It's not real big, or is it just a matter of only after it ends out there somewhere around Hakumba?
Correct. The fence currently ends at Hakumba Airport, just east of the small town of Hakumba. And then there is no fence through the rugged bighorn sheep terrain all the way to the desert floor.
Yeah, very rugged mountain areas, rocky mountains out there.
So we would like to see that status maintained where there is a large gap through the most rugged terrain. There are some human trafficking issues there, but it's not a main thoroughfare. It's not very welcoming to human foot traffic. Certainly vehicles can't make it through there at all.
Yeah.
The idea that some government officials just want a gigantic wall and without any consideration to hundreds of thousands of years of wildlife corridors.
So do very many people really manage to get through that very, very rugged section? I mean, if they were to have their way, these officials, and wall that section off, obviously would have a huge negative impact on the sheep. Is it really doing much good in terms of, you know, keeping undocumented immigrants or whoever they're worried about from coming across the border there? Or is the terrain so rugged that it's pretty well accomplishing that on its own?
In my opinion, it's not worth it. They have double and triple fencing down along the Tijuana border from the ocean inland to Otay, and people still manage to climb that and go through it and under it.
Yeah, tunnels.
And now there's discussion about the Carrizo Railway being reopened. And so certainly you're going to have a causeway of movement of people and drugs through there.
Yeah. What about the drought that we've had for the last 5 years, which certainly is easing somewhat now, but how much of an impact has that had on the desert bighorn population, Mark?
All forms of wildlife are going to depend on good winter rains and good spring green-up for the forage, whether you're talking about insects or reptiles or small birds. Certainly bighorn depend directly on spring vegetation green-up. And even though people thought this was an El Nino year, 2015 and 16, we still registered a little over half our average in Borrego Springs and in the desert region. So the drought is still in full swing. In order to have young survive, the females are going to have plentiful green up and nutrition in order to produce milk. And we have, you know, a significant number of lambs being born. Probably 80 to 90% of the females do give birth.
That's good.
But then we have very high mortality rates in late spring, early summer.
Is that because of lack of water here or disease or other factors that we'll be getting into in a moment?
Yeah, it's very complex. So it's multiple factors. We can't just pin a very complex problem down to one or two simple solutions, but we do know that it works in combination.
Do predators take very many of the lambs? Mountain lions, eagles, anything else? Coyotes?
Mountain lions are the primary predator of bighorn sheep in our area. In the 1990s and early 2000s, we documented fairly common predation by mountain lions on bighorn sheep.
Which are protected now from hunting and shooting. So,
right. And you know, you'll have two sides of that controversy as well. People that think mountain lions are in trouble and cannot be taken, and other people who think that if you took a great number of mountain lions, it would allow bighorn sheep to just spring back magically. Doesn't really work that way. We've seen high predation levels suppressing bighorn sheep, and then when environmental factors reverse and we start getting more rain, more green up, we saw the sheep population rebound and the mountain lion predation backed off quite a bit.
For centuries, the local desert bighorn sheep have had to contend with primarily natural cycles of drought and rainfall and predation and so forth, and then later the introduction of domestic sheep into their territory. But in recent years, we've also seen an influx of development of various types, everything from golf courses to, you know, resorts, and most recently these massive-scale green energy projects, the desert wind projects, industrial-scale wind projects and solar projects. What kind of impact are those projects having on the desert bighorn, and in your opinion, does that threaten their potential for survival over the long term?
It is a great potential threat, and it's a real threat in the big developments that have already been constructed. Many times these things are sited out in the desert, and I think society feels that put them out in the desert, they're out of sight, out of mind. And with government support, unfortunately, they've been put into some very valuable wildlife corridors.
So, yeah, I remember that you told us at one point about a report that the Anza Borrego Desert Park folks were trying to prepare that would be voicing concerns about the Ocotillo Wind Project when it was proposed, when there were hearings going on that the federal government was holding on that, and that wound up being suppressed. Did that report include concerns about the impact on the bighorn sheep of this wind project, which shared a 5-mile, or does share, it's been built now, a 5-mile border with the Anza Borrego Desert State Park?
Correct. And, you know, we've had state and federal government support of these mega industrial projects, whether solar panels or wind generation. And we have provided testimony at many of these meetings prior to construction, pleading with these organizations to consider wildlife concerns. And unfortunately, the government, in large part, has swept our concerns under the carpet. And in the case of the wind generator plant, when asked their opinions, the park folks unfortunately had to say they didn't have opinions. The government, state government, had told them to basically put a muzzle on it, and they didn't want state employees who really knew the situation on the ground countering what Governor Brown had approved.
Yeah, and the federal government, I think, shares some blame here, too. I know that they inexplicably delisted that entire project site and said it was no longer critical bighorn sheep habitat, even though everybody out there said, you see bighorn all the time. It took our photographer exactly one day, when I asked him to go document bighorn sheep on the project site. He documented, I believe it was 11 of them, 11 or 12, standing there on the site. There was GPS on the photo, ear tags, tracking tags on these animals. Absolutely no question what they were, where they were, when this was taken. And when we sent this to the Secretary of the Interior, Salazar, his response was to order the issuance of take permits, allowing the wind developer to inadvertently kill up to 11 or 12 sheep, however many were actually shown in our photograph, rather than doing anything at all to protect them. And then after the project was approved and built, you know, despite all this evidence, people out there told us they quit seeing the sheep for a long time, and then when they dropped the big blade off and had to shut it down for 3 months, the sheep came back for a while and then left again when the project was powered back up. So it just seems like there's a lot of evidence, if they just open their eyes and look at it, to see that it's impacting, at the very least, the migratory ability of the sheep to move through this area, whether the actual noise or infrasound, you know, may also be impacting them, who knows.
And one of the towers was allowed, as you said, under a take permit to be placed right in a bighorn lambing area where we knew six bighorn females traditionally came to the same spot that they felt was safe.
Wow.
And so there was a take permit provided for six females and six lambs. And this is just not how our society should operate. When we are armed with good scientific information, we should step back a little bit. I mean, they started that project with over 200 wind turbines, and they ended up with 117.
Yeah.
So to go to 115 or 112 or whatever to accommodate bighorn lambing would have been Really no net change for that operation.
Yeah, which is worth noting. It has underproduced ever since it was built. It has yet to ever meet its capacity factor that was promised all 3 years. It's come in substantially.
So what these projects do is you cut off bighorn movement here, you cut it off over there, and what that does is it fragments the bighorn habitat, where in prehistoric times we had free movement of animals from one mountain range across an open valley to another mountain range all the way into Baja. Now we have fragmented this into islands of habitat.
Yeah.
And we have Interstate 8, Interstate 10, wind farms. When these projects are allowed to be built within bighorn habitat, whether it's a border fence or a canal or a wind generator plant, one after another, whether it's a border fence or a highway or a canal or a golf course right up against, you know, into a canyon, these things preclude bighorn free movement, which they've had for hundreds of thousands of years. And it creates islands of habitat instead of an open, what we call a metapopulation, where animals can move in response to drought, disease, large-scale fires. Mm-hmm. They have a lot more resilience in a large swath of habitat.
Yeah, I would think the islands could also contribute to inbreeding over time. I mean, you need a healthy population that's large enough to keep a healthy gene pool, right?
It could. We have studied that, and we found out that since rams do move long distances as far as 75 or 100 miles,
wow,
it doesn't take too many incursions by a ram to do away with that inbreeding concern. But in the long term, you've created these small islands of habitat, and they become much more vulnerable to whatever natural or human-caused catastrophe might beset that habitat.
We need to pause just a moment for station identification. You're listening to the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, the network for social justice. Now we're back with bighorn sheep expert and author Mark Jorgensen.
Now, I've heard some talk about creating special wildlife overpasses on freeways. That's been done in some other countries. Tell us about that and whether that is something that could be helpful to our local bighorn population.
It definitely could, and we've been studying it for about 20 years, and it's about time that we took action on that. Interstate 8 is a prime example. We have animals crossing four lanes of traffic almost daily.
Wow, yeah, I've had
Mountain
readers
Springs
send
grade.
Us photos of that pretty regularly.
And we've had quite a few animals get killed, and we know that it's happening. We have water, a water source adjacent to the highway, and as this population has expanded, which has been a good thing, the numbers have increased in that southern population from a group of about 30 back in the 70s and 80s to over 200 now. So that's all a good thing, but that means that you have to provide this historic habitat, you know, in a high-quality fashion.
Yeah.
And I-8 was widened in 1963. During construction, there were bighorns seen every day, and for about 30 or 40 years, they were absent from there.
Wow.
Now they're back. They're getting hit by vehicles. There's probably, you know, many tens of thousands of vehicles a day.
So what would it take to get one of these wildlife bridges built?
The state of Arizona built three over on Highway 93 between Kingman, Arizona and Hoover Dam. They've been extremely successful. In the first 20 months of operation, they documented more than 2,000 crossings by bighorn sheep. So these things are, it's a matter of government action. And so these wildlife overpasses, really, the science is out on them. We don't need to study it anymore. We need to find out where to build them, and we need government funding. We need the initiative. We need some action to allow these bighorn free movement between these islands of habitat without being struck and killed. It'll also benefit public safety because a 220-pound ram coming through your windshield is a threat to human safety. And so in Arizona, they've completely eliminated motor vehicle accidents with bighorn. We've had thousands of sheep crossings documented with cameras. Very successful.
Wonderful program. Well, let's hope they can get that going here. couple of more questions. What are some of the most interesting facts about Bighorn that you would like to share with our listeners that you have learned in the course of your many years of research, as well as your wonderful book about the Desert Bighorn?
Yeah, we put the book together, Desert Bighorn Sheep Wilderness Icon, Jeff Young being the photographer.
It's beautiful photography, by the way. I highly recommend this book. It's published by Sunbelt Publishing right here in East County, and the photography is just stunning.
We had that difficult challenge of selecting from more than 60,000 photos that Jeff Young had taken, and we put 200 of them in this coffee table book. Our big goal there was to help educate the general public. I think people are fascinated to know that desert bighorn sheep still thrive in San Diego County, mm-hmm. right here where we all live in our backcountry, and they're thriving throughout the Southwest and into Mexico. But our goal was to help people learn more about this valuable wildlife species. And when we hear about potential threats or developments out in the desert, my goal is to develop a higher level of awareness and education among the citizens of San Diego County. So when they hear about a development going in, they can express their concern. And I think once you look at the book and read it, go out and see Bighorn, I feel we all have an obligation to sound the alarms when we hear that something threatens this valuable wildlife species.
So what can people do specifically? Are there particular actions that you recommend the public take if they are concerned about preserving our local bighorn sheep?
I think when they hear about projects, whether it's more solar, whether it's Sunrise Power Link expanding, we hear about golf courses around Palm Springs, La Quinta, that are being notified they have to build fences to exclude bighorn. Border fence, anytime you hear that, the re-entry of the Carrizo Railroad into Carrizo Gorge, bighorn will die. There hadn't been a train there in 34 years, and they actually used the tunnels for shade.
Oh, my goodness.
And while the train was operational, I went in and recovered two bighorn that had been hit by the trains. Mm. We know it's going to cause mortalities. So I would just ask the general public to call their legislators, county board of supervisors, and especially if you hear about another large-scale energy project out in the desert, to voice your concerns, come to public meetings, support groups that are doing the right thing, land acquisition, research projects, and we have the Anza Borrego Foundation that supports acquisition of bighorn habitat in
right.
Eastern County.
It's also a good idea, isn't it, to reach out to state and federal representatives, your members of Congress, your members of the state legislature, because so many of those decisions about the desert lands are out of the hands of the local supervisors. The railway, maybe they have a say-so over, but not if it's on, say, Bureau of Land Management land or some of these other places that have been impacted by the big projects.
I saw a piece on the local news TV about the railroad the other day, and I've been following it. I've written stories about it. I've researched it. It is not a moneymaker. It's almost impossible to keep it operational mm-hmm. because of fires, earthquakes, floods, natural disasters, the economy. And all I heard is this is going to be great for international trade between the U.S. and Mexico,
yeah.
and it's going to be a jobs creator. I didn't hear one word about the environment. You know, I'm not going to go out and make a big deal out of it. It's a dedicated railroad, and just let the chips fall where they will. But I predict it won't last 5 years, and it's not a good thing for the desert wilderness or for bighorn sheep. And I think that someone, when they come up with these big ideas, they should consider the environment once in a while.
Yeah, definitely. Just because it sounds green doesn't necessarily mean that it is, with the case of some of these big solar and wind projects and transportation and elsewhere. Now, the public can participate in the annual Desert Bighorn Sheep Count each year. It's in July. It's not for the faint at heart, but tell us about that.
We have been conducting an annual 4th of July Bighorn Sheep Count in Anza Borrego since 1971. And we generally solicit volunteers, mm-hmm. between 60 and 70 of them. And the difficult part for volunteers is they are assigned to a water source that is visited by bighorn sheep, at least we hope is, and they sit there for 3 full days in the shade, a couple hundred yards back from the water.
Yeah, and we might be talking shade when it's 115 degrees out there.
Some days they're lucky and it's only 103 or 105. Other days it's 118. So it is not for the faint of heart. And we have a mandatory orientation program. Mm-hmm.
So if people want to get involved despite the hardships. You do get spectacular photos if you're a photographer out there. How do they sign up?
They can get ready for the summer of 2017 by sending their name, address, and their email and phone number out to Anne's Borrego Desert State Park in Borrego Springs. Attention, Ranger Steve Beer. And he will put those potential volunteers on a mailing list. And next spring, he will notify them all when the count and the mandatory orientation program would be. And they can get involved. We've had people, one individual's been on 44 out of the 45 we've had. Many people have been on 20 or 30 of them in a row.
My goodness. Is there a fascinating fact or two about bighorn sheep you'd like to share with our listeners before we wrap this interview up?
You know, through the use of technology, we have gained a lot of knowledge in the last 20 years. And today we have not only radio telemetry collars, but we've moved on to GPS collars and actually satellite collars that send info directly to a computer. So we've been shocked to see if some of the long-range movements, especially among the rams. We had one ram that we put a radio collar on down in Carrizo Gorge below the railroad, and he went missing. We searched for him with radio receivers, and we were astounded to find him 75 miles away in the Santa Rosa Mountains.
Wow.
All the way at the north end of the park. He'd gone through about 5 different mountain ranges, crossed about 3 or 4 paved highways.
He really got around.
And during the mating season, they go on these walkabouts in search of females.
Fascinating.
It drove home the idea that we need to keep these mountain ranges connected.
Yeah. What can you tell us about the relationships between our local Native American tribes and the bighorn sheep through the years?
We know through interviews with tribal elders and with a lot of the traditions that are carried on today that the desert bighorn played a very large role in the everyday life of both the Kumeyaay and the Kuya, who were native to San Diego County. We also have found several sites where bighorn were hunted by Native Americans. We find series of rock hunting blinds. So we know they were an important food source. They were also very important, you know, in the spiritual life of Native Americans.
Use the horns and everything.
Yeah. So, you know, and they continue to be valuable to not only the Native American groups, but to people in our society today. We have a lot of folks who gain strength just knowing that wild bighorn are out in the wilderness.
Yeah.
And also folks that want to go out. I just met a guy this morning, had breakfast with him, and he was going out to photograph bighorn again.
Yeah, they're very inspiring. It's such a thrill to see one in the wild.
So we put the name Wilderness Icon in our book because these things truly are a symbol of wild places. They live in pure wilderness and in wild lands, and we would like to be able to nurture those wild habitats throughout America and Mexico.
Well, Mark, it has been such a pleasure having you here. Listeners, if you just tuned in, we've been speaking with Mark Jorgensen, who is the former supervisor of the Anza Borrego Desert State Park, a biologist, and the author of a wonderful new book called Desert Bighorn Wilderness Icon. You can get that through Sunbelt Publishing right here in East County. Mark, thank you so much for joining us today on the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ.
Thank you, and thank you for everything you do to preserve our environment here in San Diego County.
This is KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso in the heart of San Diego's East County.
Besides stocking up on back-to-school supplies for your children, you need to make sure their vaccinations are up to date. A new state law requires that all California school children be vaccinated, including public and private schools, as well as daycare centers. The only exceptions are for homeschooled or independent study students who do not attend classes, or if a doctor has authorized an exemption for medical reasons, such as allergy to a vaccine ingredient. Religious or personal belief exemptions are no longer allowed under the law. The lower the number of unvaccinated students, the less likely it is for disease outbreaks to occur, said Wilma Wooten, county public health officer. The law was enacted following a measles outbreak in California that spread to multiple states. About 2.4% of all children in kindergarten statewide last year still lacked at least some vaccines, down from 4.5% a year earlier. Public health officials hope to reduce that number to nearly zero, with only children who have medical exemptions remaining unvaccinated. According to the Centers for Disease Control, kids ages 4 to 6 need 4 vaccines, DTaP, which includes diphtheria, tetanus, and whooping cough, chickenpox, MMR, which includes measles, mumps, and rubella, and polio. Preteens and teens need a booster shot to protect against tetanus, diphtheria, and whooping cough. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention also recommends additional shots for teens, such as meningitis. Flu vaccines are urged for all school children. If you don't have medical insurance, you can get free vaccines at a public health clinic. Vaccines are available through some pharmacies. For more information, call the county's Health and Human Services Agency Immunization Branch at 866-358-2966 or visit sdiz.org. The new law will face a legal challenge. A suit filed by Education for All, a local parents group, claims the law violates California's guaranteed right to an education for every child. But unless a court issues an injunction, children who are unvaccinated will not be admitted to California schools this fall. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Chisato Iverson.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, recording at our studio in the East County Wellness Center in El Cajon. My very special guest today is Don Axe, and Don is the owner of Valley View Urban Farms in Spring Valley, and he's going to be telling us all about urban farming and homesteading, even in a small space, as we work to get back to our agricultural roots here in East County. Don, welcome to the show.
Good morning, Miriam. Nice to be here.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you. Now, listeners, a lot of you may not know that according to the Farm Bureau here in San Diego County, we have more small family farms under 10 acres than any county in America. That's right, more than Iowa or Kansas or Nebraska or anywhere else. So, Don, just how small is your urban farm?
Well, our urban farm is on a half an acre, and a lot of it is a slope. So we have maybe a quarter of an acre that we do all of our farming on.
Yeah, it's amazing. I was out and visited this, and I was just so impressed with how much you've been able to accomplish in a small space. So let's talk about, you know, some of the things you do there. But first, can you tell us a little bit about your background? How did you get into this?
Well, I was kind of born into it. My grandparents had a 20-acre farm up in Escondido, and they raised cows and horses and planted a lot of vegetables. So I couldn't wait to get up there and spend the summer with my grandparents growing up. And so it's kind of born into me, and enjoy doing it my whole life, off and on. So I've been able to start this urban farm here in Spring Valley and be able to provide for family with organic products and some
extras to sell, as well as classes that you teach, and we'll be talking more about that in a minute. But first, tell us about the hydroponics. For those who aren't familiar with it, you raise vegetables and fruits both via hydroponics, which is essentially in water, and also soil grown in raised beds. What's involved in getting started in the hydroponics, and why do that? It seems a little bit counterintuitive since we're in a drought. How does that work?
Well, typically a hydroponic system will save about 95% water use over a ground or soil garden. So a lot of evaporation goes on with the soil. But with the hydroponics, it's pretty much a closed system. So we'll start our seedlings and put them in our hydroponic system, and within a month, they're completely grown and ready for harvest.
You were using what they call a floating bed for this?
A floating mat system, where it's insulation, a mat of 4x8 floating mat on a on about 6 or 8 inches of water.
Mm-hmm. And how big is the raised bed?
It's before 4 feet by 8 feet. Mm-hmm. So we can typically grow about 60 heads of lettuce in that area within a month.
Wow, that's amazing.
So very fast. We don't have to worry about weeds or gophers.
Instant salad bar.
Yes.
Okay. Now, in addition to that, you also have vegetables and fruits even growing in raised planter beds and just about everything else. Tell us about where you get your materials to build the beds from.
Sure. When I started this, I didn't have much money because I'd 2008 came and I had a construction-related industry that was not going to be staying alive. So I was looking around to be able to start growing some things for our family and providing a healthy food for us. Mm-hmm. So a great source was a free list on Craigslist. So I would gather products and different things that people were getting rid of and mm-hmm. not wanting to use. Also, there were a lot of homes in foreclosure where people were having to get rid of their animals and cages and different things like
wow.
that. So I kind of gleaned off the land and
yeah.
everything at the farm is made of repurposed material.
Now, we're recording this in February, listeners. I was out there in January and you had red ripe strawberries. Eat your heart out, East Coast folks, in the middle of the blizzard while we were out sampling strawberries.
Right. Yeah, that was in a vertical growing system that we mm-hmm. had, basically a trash can with slices cut in the side around, and the strawberries would grow out of it.
Yeah, very innovative. Now, speaking of animals, you've also got all kinds of farm animals out there mm-hmm. in that small space. Tell us a little bit about what you have.
Well, we have dairy goats, 3 female dairy goats, Beverly, Katie, and Sadie.
Mm-hmm.
We also have chickens that we raise for eggs.
Yeah, all different kinds. How many mm-hmm. different types of chickens do you have?
We have about 8 or 10 different breeds, mm-hmm. Quite a variation of color and color of eggs. We'll get pink and blue and green and
wow.
brown and white.
So Easter's coming up, listeners. You don't have to dye the eggs. Just get some chickens that lay them in colors. How interesting. You also have ducks and turkeys, I understand.
Ducks, turkeys, rabbits. The rabbits that we raise are Flemish Giant. Rabbits.
Adorable. How big is the Flemish Giant?
One of them is about 20 pounds. The world record right now for a Flemish Giant is 55 pounds.
Oh my goodness.
So that's quite the rabbit.
You sell those for pets if people want?
They make incredible pets. They're very docile. They get very large. And a friend of ours has one of them that we sold to them, and mm-hmm. the rabbit sleeps with a girl at night in
oh,
the bed.
And gorgeous. And they don't bark? And they don't scratch?
No. They do chew on wires, though.
Uh-oh. We've got to watch that.
Yeah.
But they're adorable. You also had a pot-bellied pig out there.
Right. Her name's Piglet, mm-hmm. and she's our little farm pig. She'll greet you at the gate looking for food mm-hmm. and follow you around,
yeah.
make sure you're doing everything that you need to do. So she's quite the funny pig. So.
Now, those of us that work in regular jobs talk about bringing home the bacon, but you really do that. I understand mm-hmm. you have a second farm out in Hamul that's, what, about 3/4 of an acre?
Yeah, about an acre that we use. We also raise organic free-range chickens and free-range pork there.
Mm-hmm.
We do all the processing ourselves. When we process bacon, sausage, ham, we don't use nitrates or nitrites to preserve them. So it's
wow.
do our own smoking. Mm-hmm. So they are good, healthy meat, and a lot of people are very impressed by them.
Yeah. And then right there at your backyard in Spring Valley, you've got a barn, and you do cheese making, as well as other products from the dairy goats that you raise
right.
from the milk. What else do you make?
Right. Well, we start off with the milk. Of course, it's all organic milk, so it's very healthy,
mm-hmm.
Which we do sell by the quart. And we process the milk into cheese, lotion, soap, ice cream. That's about all we'll use for. So
wonderful. I know my mother was raised on a farm in Texas years ago, and it's really a set of skills that have been lost largely in today's generation of kids growing up. But in her day, she said they raised absolutely everything they needed. They only had to go to town to buy coffee and sugar. Are we kind of seeing a reversal back to that trend, a little bit of interest in the new generation wanting to learn how to live off the land again, Don?
Yeah, I would hope to see that. We've come to a point where everything is so fast food and organized that's in a lot of ways unhealthy ways. So my focus has been providing healthy food and teaching people how to raise that themselves.
And yeah, speaking of the teaching, you do all kinds of classes out there at Valley View Urban Farm. Tell us some of the things people can learn if they sign up for the classes.
Sure. Our most popular one is cheese making. We'll learn to milk the goats right before we make the cheese. And within 2 hours, you'll come and make three different kinds of cheeses. And you can take home a product and samples and learn how to do that and do it yourself.
That sounds delicious. You also teach classes in canning. You know, you can't eat all those vegetables all in one fell swoop in the season, right, so you can save some for the winter months.
Sure.
Fermenting. Tell us about that.
Fermenting class is very interesting. You'll learn how to make sauerkraut, which is one of the healthiest probiotic foods that you can eat when it's made by yourself.
Yeah.
It's a lot more healthy because there are no other additives that people put in.
So. Bread making, where do you get the grain?
We buy organic whole wheat. We grind it ourselves. It's also in a class. Learn how to make bread. Mm-hmm. Sourdough bread is our specialty, which is, in these days, gluten-free because the fermentation eats up the gluten in the sourdough bread. So it's very good for people that are gluten intolerant.
Very nice. And then you teach people how to raise chickens and goats and pigs and all of these other animals we've been talking about also, I presume?
Correct, yeah. All the intricacies that goes into taking care of these animals and keeping them healthy and productive for their lives and giving them a great life.
Also, soap making and lotion making.
Mm-hmm.
Nice.
We do specialized different types of lotion, which are all made from goat milk, as well as the soaps.
Very good. I understand you also have some construction classes geared toward folks that may be doing a little bit of farming and want to learn how to make things. Tell us about that.
Sure. My background has been in construction for a long time as well as culinary, but I was very interested in alternative building practices. So we have classes in straw bale building and cordwood building, and I've also built a lot of log homes.
Wow.
So that's not too many around here.
Fabulous. And people can also find you teaching in some of our county libraries.
Right. The county libraries have contracted with me to come and teach different classes.
Very cool.
The Crest Library, the Ramona Library.
Yeah. So you can check the San Diego County Library schedule to get the latest classes coming up, listeners.
Correct.
Now, we've saved the best for last. I'm sure a lot of you are wondering, how on earth do you do all this stuff in such a small space? Again, this half-acre farm in Spring Valley and a one-acre one out in Jamul. You can learn more at valleyviewurbanfarm.com, but also very soon, Don is going to be hosting a segment coming up for us on the East County Magazine radio show called Backyard Homesteading.
Correct. Looking forward to sharing my knowledge and wisdom about different things that I've learned and being able to pass it on to you and encourage you to do the same.
Very good. Don, I want to thank you for joining us today on the East County Magazine show on KNSJ. And we're going to end, listeners, by playing the intro to our upcoming backyard homesteading segment that Don Axe is going to be generously hosting for us. So listen up.
Hi, this is Don Axe at Valley View Urban Farm, your host of the Backyard Homestead, your how-to source for urban farming, homesteading, even in a small space, and getting back to our agricultural roots.
This concludes today's episode of East County Magazine's radio show. We extend our appreciation to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble and Pond 5. If you have story ideas or would like to underwrite the East County Magazine radio show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org or call 619-698-7617. We'll be back soon for another edition of East County Magazine's radio show.